I'm pausing because I'm not sure how to make the topic of the process of creation interesting for kids. Because that's what the topic is. Well, I'll start with two statements, or a statement and a little story, personal story. When Sataputta, a godbrother of mine who was a graduate from Cornell University with a mathematics degree, PhD in mathematics, was given the assignment by Srila Prabhupada to study the fifth canto and make a planetarium. You probably had to look up in the encyclopedia what a planetarium is. Yeah, you had to make one. It was a very daunting challenge. And when he finished his work, or reached a certain level of his work, he produced a DVD. He called it Mysteries of the Sacred Universe, where he describes how the Vedas explain the structure of the universe. One of the topics, there's the beginning of the 10th chapter of this canto, is there's 10 topics, and one of the topics is sthanam, which means the positioning of the planets in the universe. Children will be children, right? So, at the beginning of that DVD, he says, he makes a statement, the way that we view the universe has a significant impact upon how we view ourselves. And that's a nice thought, because kind of obviously we're in the universe, and so how we view the universe has some impact on how we, significant impact on how we view ourselves. Now, those of you that are going to school for so many years, you're going to be hearing a picture of the universe where God just disappears. In fact, he never even appears to disappear. He just isn't there. A picture of the universe where God isn't there. And what does that picture look like? I was speaking on this subject, the mysteries of the sacred universe, to a group of, IGSA, Indian Graduate Student Association at one university. Graduate students, you know, working on their master's or doctor's degree. There were about 60 or 70 of them in one hall, kind of like a little mini amphitheater. And at the end, question-answer discussion. One of the students asked a question. Is there anything in the picture of Vedic cosmology or the structure of the universe that is anything like the Big Bang? You know what the Big Bang is? Once upon a time, and the universe came into being. And what did that Big Bang come from? They call it a singularity. You know what a singularity is? You'll hear about it in school, so I'll give you a sneak preview. You know what a singularity is? Huh? It's a dimensionless point with unlimited mass. No, a point has some dimension, but this is a dimensionless point with unlimited mass. And then, the mass went flying all over the place, and look out, here comes a big chunk of mass. It's called our universe. So, is there any something similar, conceptually, to Big Bang and Veda cosmology? And I replied that our spiritual master was once asked that question. And he said something like, because once he asked what the idea was, he said from each of the pore holes, you know, a pore, a little where perspiration comes from in your body, one of the pore holes of the body of Mahavishnu, unlimited universes come streaming out. Maybe there's some similarity, he said. From a dimensionless point, like, you know, something for this on a spiritual plane, you can't measure the size of the Lord's pores. From that, from the unmanifest state of matter, the manifest, we're going to read about it in the verses today. There's a seed, a spiritual seed, and from the spiritual seed, then a body called the universe forms around that seed of the universe, and the whole thing grows, like seeds grow. Because they don't have any, remember, God's just dropped out of the picture. You have to study these kinds of things, and there's a rule. God's gotta be off in the corner, or you know, outside. Not inside. Not in the discussion. Because it's a rule. The separation of church and state. That's one rule. Another rule is you gotta go to school. Compulsory education. Put those two together. You get a picture of the universe that's godless. So then, another one. What's up? Little guy, huh? Okay, he's nice. He's harmless. So, then another student said, that's interesting because from science, modern science, mathematically, they've shown right down to milliseconds before the Big Bang happened, mathematically, exactly what happened up to that, you know, when the singularity exploded. The milliseconds afterward, they have it all down in math. And then I asked the question, well, what do they say happens after that? Like, you know, up to this point in time, what happens going out into the future? Go that direction. What about that direction? And he said, well, there's two theories. And one theory is because of mass, like the Earth has mass, so it has gravity, right? That's their theory. There's a problem in the theory because 90% of the mass of the universe is missing, but the theory is because of mass, then the planets hold in their space. But if they keep moving and moving and moving and moving, at one point of time, either one of two things are predicted. Either it's just going to go out into nothingness. That's one theory. And the other theory is that it will implode back upon itself, back to a singularity. And they said that second one is favored by one Harvard professor, very famous guy, I forget his name, who says he likes the Vedic model of time that time is cyclical. So everything comes and then it returns to where it came from. I said, well, in both of those ideas, let's look at this end of time and that end of time. And everything starts from nothing and everything goes to nothing. So what does that say about right now? It's nothing. And that's our picture of the universe. Eat, drink, and be merry for tomorrow. And for that matter today. For that matter right now. Nothing. Nothing. Life is meaningless. Life is expendable. If I can take another person's life and get away with it, it's okay. And for that matter, just like existentialists, when I was in high school, I had to read a book in French because I was studying French. So Albert Camus was a French author who wrote The Stranger. So I had to read it in French. It was a very strange book. It was about an existentialist. You know what existentialism is? You read the book in French? Basically, it's nothing matters. It's the story of a life of a man who goes through life and nothing matters. And he experiences things and nothing matters. And his anger doesn't get matter. He kills somebody and it doesn't matter. He gets put in jail. It doesn't matter. He gets sentenced to death and it doesn't matter. Very strange. A life of existentialism where nothing matters. Because we come from nothing. And we go to nothing, so nothing really matters. You know, he acknowledges, I take responsibility for my act of killing, which doesn't matter because punishment doesn't matter. Very strange. L'étranger. The stranger. And so the picture of where the universe comes from and where the universe goes to and where we are now is absolutely impersonal in the modern picture of things through modern science. And Prabhupada writes in this section that we're reading that other than from the Vedas, how do you know about what lies beyond creation? Like, where did it all come from? Look up into the sky. Well, there's an urban situation. You don't see it so well. Go someplace in the country. Like last time I was in New Vrindavan, I was looking up in the sky. It's awesome. I mean, all that stuff up there. All those stars twinkling and planets and constellations. Oh, there's the Big Dipper. There's this one. There's that one. There's Scorpio. And I'm normally living in a city. So you don't look up in a city. You don't see the same heavens, the firmament in the sky. But it's since the beginning of time, it's something that thoughtful people have pondered. How vast is this place? And how it's structured, and you go the other direction. Somebody sent me, trying to make our subject matter interesting. There was somebody put it, I can send it out to some of you and you can circulate it to the others. It's a PowerPoint thing. It just goes on its own. You click and it's place in Florida near Tallahassee. And then you see some trees and then you go up by the power of 10. And by the power of 10, and by the power of 10, and by the power of 10. You just see, you know, that the earth fades into this, and then another power of 10, and you see the galaxy, and the galaxy is in the whole vast, and it looks like just a bunch of speckles. And then you go back down a power of 10, and then you go down to that place in Tallahassee, Florida. Then go down a power of 10 and you see the trees. You go to the leaf. You go in the leaf. You go inside the inside of the leaf, inside the mitochondria cell within the, inside that and inside that into the power of 10. And it looks, you get to the other side and it's just a bunch of speckles. So from what frame of reference are you looking at if you're just looking at matter? And the symmetry and the composition, no matter how far you go, there's something there. And where does it begin and where does it end and how did it come into being? It begs the question. I mean, a thoughtful person will start to pull on their chin and say, oh, how does this all come to be? This complexity, the design, you know, and how it, the laws that govern it and the keeping, the maintaining of those laws, you know, try to keep a law of your sandals. You don't have control of them. You wear them for a while, they wear out. Someone walks off with them, or you put them somewhere, forget where you put them. But the universe doesn't work like that. It's so complex, and it's so structured, so systematic. So, that's the subject that is discussed here. And the good news is, this is from the picture of the source as a person. And where it all goes to the limited expanse, unlimited expanses of time, as it goes back to a person. So that means now what everything is resting up on person. And that's the Vedic picture. And then the question has been asked earlier in this canto is now going to be explained again, is how does it work? How does from a person all of this stuff come into being and be, how is it supported by that person? What's it all about? How does it work? It describes. And in the fifth canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, where that section of the 10 topics, the one that's describing the structure of the universe, it gives numbers of distances and sizes of planets and time periods of their orbits. And, you know, you look up at those stars and wonder, how did they figure all that out? And one of the things that you're going to learn, and at least I learned in eighth grade science, was the Copernicus model of a sun-centered universe. Eighth grade still? Later on? Okay. The Vedic model of that, what we read in Srimad Bhagavatam is an earth-centered model. I'm doing this to keep all the young people's attention. Okay. How do we do this? Okay. Here's the sun. This, my left hand here is the sun. And it's sending out rays of light. And the earth is moving around the sun. Right? That's the sun-centered model. And then over here, here's the earth. We have a little moon that's moving around the earth. Right? The moon moves around the earth, while the earth moves around the sun. Right? So if you were to map the movement of the moon going around the earth as the earth goes around the sun, what do you get? Kids only. Adults can think, but I want to see someone volunteer. What do you get? What do you get? Do it again. Here's the sun. It's supposedly stationary. It does move, but the earth is moving around the sun, and the moon is moving around the earth. So you're mapping the moon moving around the earth as the earth moves around the sun. What do you get? What's the motion? Yes, he's got it. It's a spiral. They call it a spirograph. Now, next question. Map it hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times. Many, many, many times. What do you get? You get a disc. Because the moon is going to cross not always in the exact same spot. So next time it's a little different, next time it's a little different, next time it's a little different. Hundreds and hundreds of times you get a disc with an outer and inner dimension centered around the sun. And actually it's even three-dimensional, so you get like a inner tube of a car or your bicycle or something. It's puffed up a little bit, three-dimensional, like a lifesaver. We know what lifesavers are. Okay. Now, it's going to get tougher. Okay, now, this time, my left fist is the earth. And I want to describe to you the motion of the sun. This is eighth grade science, so, but you'll get it, it's easy. Here's the earth, and now we're gonna show you the motion of the sun as the sun moves in relation to the earth. Yes, it does. The sun moves in relation to the earth because we just had, what was the longest day of the summer? June 21, right. June 21. Called the summer solstice. That's where the sun is in the northern hemisphere at the northernmost point. Okay? Then it starts to move down towards what's the middle? It's called the equator, right? In 1 year's time, it makes a complete circle around the earth, and it crosses over the equator where the days and nights are equal. And that's called the equinox. Okay, but it keeps going into the southern hemisphere, down, 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 where it's the longest night and the shortest day. And that's called winter solstice, or in India, it's Makara Sankranti. You've heard of Makara Sankranti, right? Kids? Okay. January 21st. Or January 14th. 14th. January 14th. By the solar calendar. It changes by lunar calendar, but... And that's when the sun starts to move in a northerly direction. You know when Grandfather Bhishma decided to give up his body? It was just after that. The sun began moving in the northern direction. Makara Sankranti. Because according to Bhagavad Gita and the teachings that explain about the yoga system, when the sun is moving in the northerly direction, if a yogi gives up his body at that time, he ascends into the heavenly regions. So he gave up his body at that time. Okay, so now the sun's going up, 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 up. And it crosses the equator again. And when it crosses the equator, another equinox. And it goes up, 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 all the way to the top. In the northernmost part of the hemisphere. You know what that is? There's the, what are those latitudes? One at the bottom and one at the top. Tropic of Cancer and Tropic of Capricorn. Tropic of Capricorn is all the way at the bottom. Tropic of Capricorn is at the bottom because is anybody here that's born in latter part of December or the early part of January? Anyone, adults? No. Latter part of December, early part of January.
Yeah, January.
Okay. So what is the constellation? It's Capricorn. Capricorn. The Tropic of Capricorn is that line of latitude. Latitude? you know, the ones that go this way, they're longitude. The ones that go this way, that's latitude. It will always, like, you know, have a ball at the very, towards the very bottom of the ball, you just draw a circle. That's the Tropic of Capricorn, because the sun reaches the southernmost point during that month, latter December, early January. And up, 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 Tropic of Cancer during the month of June. Tropic of, you know, so the constellation, the sun, are you interested in this? This is Vedic astronomy and astrology. Okay. So, but we're gonna have another map. So you gotta pay attention to these. So, we're in the northernmost hemisphere. Northernmost region of the hemisphere. The northern hemisphere, at the topmost part where the sun goes. So, that's June 21st. Maybe it's 14th. June 21st, I think it is. Okay, so, now, I just made a statement that says, that line on which the sun moves is called the ecliptic. The ecliptic. The path of the sun, as it moves once a year, rotating around the earth. Okay, so now we're going back to, here's the earth, and the sun is moving around the earth once a year. Okay, so now, listen carefully. If you wanted to map the planet Mars, or Jupiter, or Venus, or Saturn, let's take Saturn. We want to map Saturn, as Saturn is moving around the sun, as the sun moves around the earth. The sun moves around the earth once a year. The sun is moving around the earth once a year. Now we want to map Saturn as Saturn moves around the sun, as the sun moves around the earth. What do you get? A spiral. And you do it many, many times, and what do you get? You get a disc with a outer radius and an inner radius. Right? The fifth canto of the Bhagavatam, get ready for this, gives a map of our solar system with exact dimensions of the orbits of the planets up to where the eye can see. That's the furthest planet the eye can see without a telescope, because they didn't have telescopes. Up to the planet Uranus and Saturn and Jupiter and Mars and Venus. As they move around the sun, as the sun moves around the earth, it gives, with numbers, the dimensions of our solar system. How big is this planet? What's the radius of its orbit when it goes, it's called apogee and perigee. They got, you know, that's our modern terms. So they don't have that language in Sanskrit. It calls it an island with a dimension of, from this side to that side dimension. With the earth in the center. Now, when you look up at the planets in the sky, all those guys up there, all the stars and twinkling planets, could you imagine measuring them? Could you imagine measuring their orbits around the sun? As the sun moves, how did they do it? With very careful numbers. Now, when you go to school and you're going to learn about the Copernicus sun-centered model, ask the teacher, maybe you can do it politely, ask the teacher, what did Copernicus say was the distance between the earth and the sun? And they say, I don't know. But you can say, the distance that Copernicus said, because he had a telescope, it was off by a factor of something like 70. It was way off. Mm-hmm. But then as telescopes got better, it got closer. Then they made these super Hubble telescopes, and it got even better. And they put the Hubble telescopes on top of rocket ships and sent them into space and sent pictures from the Hubble telescope as it went zoom, zoom, zooming around and sent images back to Earth. And the scientists would take a look at those and say, well, we were really off. It's actually the distances between this and that is, and they gave another number. And you can let your teacher know, maybe not during the class, but after the class, so they don't feel threatened by your words, that these very ancient literatures gave the exact numbers. They didn't have any telescopes. They didn't have any rocket ships. They had another system of knowledge of how to understand numerically the distances between planets, the dimensions of their orbits as they moved around the sun on its ecliptic. And the teacher's going to go, where did you learn this? And your answer is going to be from Srimad Bhagavatam. You could say, Maharaj told us. But it's in the Srimad Bhagavatam, because all Maharaj is saying is what's in the Bhagavatam. And so, but, mind you, all this information is earth-centered. Earth-centered. Because that's the place where we observe things from. So does it really make a difference? If you say, the answer is no. If you say it's just relative motion. Einstein gave this theory of relativity, and the Bhagavatam already had it. Theory of relativity, of motion. The sun's in the middle. The earth moves around the sun, and the other planets move around the sun. That's the Copernicus model. The Vedic model is the earth, from our point of observation, finds the sun moving on its orbit once a year around the earth, and the planets move around the sun. It's relative motion. It says the same thing in different language. So the formulas are different, but the numbers are the same. Okay, should I do one more? One more. Okay, here's the Earth, and the Sun, it starts up here in the Northern Hemisphere, and it moves this way. Now, if you're looking from where you're sitting, and it's moving this way, is that clockwise or counterclockwise? Counterclockwise, very good. Okay, now, there's another motion of the Sun that's clockwise. Pay attention. Here's the Earth. And here's the sun. And the earth is spinning in such a way that the sun rises in the east, usually, and sets in the west. Not the other way around. Okay. Get your thinking caps on. And since the sun rises in the east and sets in the west, is that clockwise or counterclockwise motion? Every day, there's once a year motion that's counterclockwise, and there's a daily motion that's clockwise. And the Bhagavatam describes that. And when Maharaj Parikshit hears, wait a minute, clockwise, counterclockwise, it sounds contradictory. Could you explain that? Because it's not possible that Vyasadeva can contradict himself, that I know. So can you explain these counterclockwise, clockwise motions? And Shukadeva Goswami says, sure. Picture a potter's wheel. You know what a potter's wheel is? Okay, potter's wheel. And the potter's wheel is spinning very fast clockwise. That's like the earth that's spinning on its axis once every day. In relation to the sun, it moves once. Clockwise, very fast. And he said, imagine that there's ants on the potter's wheel walking counterclockwise. So how would you describe the motion of the ants? You could say, they're moving counterclockwise. But they're also moving clockwise because the potter's wheel is spinning very fast. That was his answer. So people that don't understand the Bhagavatam and think, oh, these people are primitive. Come on, ants walking on a potter's wheel clockwise. And the potter's wheel is spinning counterclockwise. Oh, come on. But it's a very simple example that even an uneducated village person can understand. You can have simultaneous clockwise and counterclockwise motion within the universe. Okay, so now we have these rishis looking up at the sky going, like we do, wow, look at all that. And we conclude, we pull on our chin and say, clockwise and counterclockwise motion. Not by pulling on our chin, but by hearing this descending knowledge that comes from the Vedas, that comes from, and the Vedas comes from Narayan. Now, those that are, their only frame of reference is what they receive in school that says God has to sit in a corner, or he's out in the playground. You can go talk about God when it's on recess, but not in school. So from that picture, when persons read the Bhagavatam, they go, gee, this is mythology. There's this Narayan who breathes the Vedas, right? And he lies on the Nara ocean, on Anantashesh, this transcendental serpent. And he gives us all this knowledge about how the universe is constructed. Right. You people are really silly. But that's what we're going to be reading about just now, about Narayana, who's lying on the causal ocean, because he's Nara. Nara means he's a person. He's a person. He's not a singularity. He's not a dimensionless point of unlimited mass. That's silly, as far as I'm concerned. He's a person. And because he's a person that has, he's God. He has inconceivable potencies, and he does with his potencies some very amazing things, but he does to reciprocate with, in a loving manner, with those living entities who are part of his, one portion of his potencies, that's the living entities, are his marginal potencies, and the portion of those marginal potencies that have a rebellious spirit towards him, he then ranges through another part of his potencies for this material world to be created. And that's what's being described. How it bhavati, how it comes into being. From an unmanifest state of his energy to a manifest state of his energy, designed by him to accommodate the desires of the living entities. It's a loving act. As we already discussed earlier today, with two purposes. One, to allow the living entities to try Mission Impossible, to try to enjoy apart from him. And the second is to correct them from that mistaken hope, desire. It's to reform that mistaken disposition. So it's a real wonderful opportunity here. Everything starts from Nara, and it ends in Nara, and God is existing in all phases of time. And it's not imaginative, It's not simply a belief. It's something that quantifiably and numerically one can understand and measure. At least, you know, during the manifest stage, and, you know, the measurements of the expanding universe, it's called an algorithm. It's how the universe is expanding. But very clearly, we're going to hear how the universe is again also withdrawn. The expanding and the contracting of the universe. They didn't need Hubble telescopes to describe it. They had descending knowledge rather than ascending knowledge. So, with this descending knowledge, we're finding out, in the pages of the Srimad Bhagavatam, how this all happened. And I'm just going to read some of the verses and then narrate a little bit, describe a little bit. After separating the different universes, that's different universes, that's another nice idea. The measurement, Prabhupada describes, even the measurement of this one universe, the scientists are not clear about. What to speak of multiple universes? What to speak of beyond the universes? As Prabhupada would say, that they do not know. But that doesn't mean nobody knows, because they do not know that that the number of universes are so many, you cannot count them all. It's finite, but so many. And the universes are separating from his body. Spiritual body, Mahavishnu. The gigantic form of the Lord. His body is so big, universes come out of the pores of his skin. He's got a big body. Of course, they come out in a seed-like state. But then, mystically, he expands himself inside each of those universes. When you think about it, that's pretty good. If you imagine something coming out of the pores of your skin, and then you could expand yourself inside whatever that is that comes out of the pores of your skin. That was stated in the fourth chapter of this canto. When Shukadeva Goswami is describing, he's meditating upon Krishna and says, you are the supreme cause of all causes, which we all know. Both the spiritual and the material realm come from you. The spiritual and the material realm come from you, and therefore you are equal to both. But at the same time, you have a liking, you reside in the spiritual realm. But while you reside in the spiritual realm, you make yourself manifest in this material realm, which is but a part of you, and you are the complete whole. This you do by your mystic potency. It's like saying, we're in an apartment somewhere in the suburbs of whatever we call it, you know, Greater Washington, whatever that might be, Greater Washington. So we are part of Greater Washington. And the statement would be like saying, the whole of Greater Washington is in the apartment. You can't do that. It's a contradiction. And physically you can't do it. But Krishna does it. He's the complete whole from which all little parts emanate, and he enters in his fullness within every part. By his inconceivable potencies. He does it within the universes. He is the source of those, it's like unlimited coming from his little pores of his transcendental body. And then he enters within each one of them. And then not only that, he enters within every atom of that universe in another expansion. So, it rolls off the tongue real easy. He's bigger than the biggest and smaller than the smallest simultaneously. He's inside of everything and outside of everything. It's a contradiction. We can be inside the room or we can be outside the room. We can't be inside the room and outside the room, but Krishna can. He's the complete whole and expands all the parts and enters within all the parts in his fullness. It's mind-boggling. It defies the mind to think of it. It's inconceivable. But Krishna does it. That's not only, he not only conceives of it, he snaps his fingers and it's done. Doesn't even have to snap his fingers. It's already done. And so in this process of creation, Mahavishnu generates the universes and then he enters within each one of the universes. Why does he do that? It's described. He desires to lie down in the Garbhadak ocean within each of those universes. And what does he want to do that for? The whole exercise, the whole talila, it's described specifically. Krishna has his leelas and Vishnu has his leelas. And his leela is in relation to creation. What he wants to do is provide a situation where living entities, that's us and those outside of this room, and even the children that are playing out here, it's to provide an opportunity for everyone to have a facility for enjoyment. At least, you know, what we hope will be enjoyment. It's to reciprocate with the desires of the living entities, to have some situation where they can try to enjoy. So he supplies, as was discussed this afternoon, he supplies senses. He supplies bodies through which the senses can work. He's the source even of the soul itself. He's this creator of this interdependent system so the living entities can have this go try to enjoy program. None of which works without his superintending the whole thing. Any one part of it that's missing doesn't work. And each of the parts is dependent upon him. But he's the independent and the others are dependent and interdependent upon one another, but dependent upon him. And he sets it all up because the living entities have this I want to enjoy thing going on. That Supreme Person is not impersonal and therefore is distinctively Nara, or a person. This is the text 11. Therefore, the transcendental water created from the supreme Nara is also known as Nara, N-A-R-A, long A, Nara. And because he lies down on the water, he is known as Narayana. Take shelter in Nara is Narayana. Is another name of Narayana. Another meaning is he's the shelter of all Naras. So he's Narayana. But here's another meaning. He lies on the Nara ocean and so he's Narayana. Srimad Bhagavatam. There's no purport. So just read. One should definitely know that all material ingredients, activities, time and modes, and the living entities, who are meant to enjoy them all, exist by his mercy only, and as soon as he does not care for them, everything becomes non-existent. Of course, there isn't a time when he doesn't care for them. But even the very existence of each of those entities described, their very existence is dependent upon the Lord's willing them to exist. If he willed them to not exist, they would not exist. Or he just withdrew, I don't care about them anymore. They would stop to exist. And that never happens. But they exist because of his mercy. Or to speak of being able to function and do anything by his mercy. It's a very important item. It's what's the message here? We're dependent. And conversely, we're not independent. But we're thinking independent. And where does that thinking independent come from? Krishna allows us to think independent by covering us with Maya. I was just listening to Prabhupada just during lunch today. Prabhupada was saying, just see how wonderful is Maya. It's who or not. It's nothing but suffering. Dukkhalayam ashashvatam. But most amazing of it all is the person in Maya thinks it's enjoyable while he's suffering. You know, like, you know, thinking of someone drinking alcohol. It's suffering. And they're thinking it's enjoyment. It's horrible. It's not just a cultural thing. People all over the world drink alcohol and it's horrible. But, well, you know, it alters their senses and, you know, their bodily chemistry. Anyway, not picking on one particular group of people, just the whole nature of Maya. It's suffering. For some momentary pleasure, whatever that might be, there's so much suffering. It destroys health, it destroys lives, it destroys relationships, causes so many deaths unnecessarily, hardships, inability to work properly, and it's called enjoyment. And they work hard so they can get some money to go and enjoy. And they cash their paycheck and go and enjoy. So, text 13. The Lord, while lying on his bed of mystic slumber, generated the seminal symbol. Seminal symbol. These are like little eggs or seeds that come from his body. It's the It's the subtle form of the universe before the ingredients amalgamate around. It's like the original act of procreation. So the Purusha supplies the seed, but he also supplies the ingredients that's called material nature. And the material nature, according to the plan of the seed, develops the body of the universe. And then within this body of the universe, he enters so that the universe will grow. He enters as Garbhadakshaya Vishnu. Please note, Prabhupada says this over and over again, bodies don't grow unless there's a soul present. Let's say, if a child grows for some time within the womb, but there's a death, premature death, the child within the womb dies. The body doesn't grow. The ingredients are there, supplying by the mother, but if the soul departs, then the body won't grow. And similarly for the universe grows because there's touch of spirit inside as the supreme soul. Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, the universe grows. And then there's this further plan that Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, because within his abdomen are all the living entities and all the material ingredients stored in her subtle dormant state. From his body, he generates a lotus stem on top of a lotus stem, very artistic. Lord Brahma appears. Brahma is called Aja, or unborn, because he's not born in a normal way. A child is born with mother and father, just from the body of Garbhadakshaya Vishnu. Then he gives to Lord Brahma the ingredients, the plan, the intelligence, the creative impetus, self-realization, perfect knowledge of the Vedas, all, everything he needs to know to do the sub-creation, because this was already described. Now he's going more deeply. So then Brahma generates living beings. From his brow come the four Kumaras. And then he requests the four Kumaras, can you assist me in this work that I have to do of creating progeny? And they say, no thanks. We just want to stay nice little brahmacharis. In fact, we're not going to grow beyond this little boy-like form. So then Lord Brahma becomes angry that they're declining this service. And then Lord Shiva appears. And so forth. Brahma has this capacity, just like the seed of the universe creates the universe because Garbhadakshaya Vishnu is present, then Garbhadakshaya Vishnu creates Brahma. And Brahma has this capacity to create other beings. He has the plan, he has the ingredients, he has the intelligence. We could have the plan that Brahma has, but we don't have the intelligence. We don't have the plan either, but we're supposing we've got the plan. Here's the blueprint. Oh my God. You know, I better go take a couple more years of engineering school before I can figure this one out. But it's not just engineering school. It's self-realization. It's knowledge from the personality of Godhead, how to do it. Imagine how intelligent Brahma is. Go take one of his courses at the university. The Lord, while lying on his bed of mystic slumber, generated the seminal symbol, golden in hue, through external energy, out of his desire to manifest varieties of living entities from himself alone. Very important, from himself alone. Going back one chapter is the Chaturshloki verses of the Bhagavatam where it says, the first one of them says, before beginning of creation, I alone exist. During the period of cosmic manifestation, I alone exist. After cosmic annihilation, I alone exist. That means during the manifest state, it's but the energies of the Supreme Lord, which he is energizing by empowering others to do things. So he empowers Brahma to do things, but that power is his power. Brahma is just the instrument of the power of the Lord. So that covers through text 13, that covers the section. Because the next section, it gets really technical. The next section is how the elements unfold one after the next, after the next, after the next. From subtle promptings, more gross elements. But it makes sense. If you want to store something very compactly, you just fold the gross into the subtle, into the subtle, into the subtle, into the subtle, and then you have it all stored in a very subtle state. You want to use it, you unfold it, and unfold it, and unfold it, and unfold it, and unfold it. Into the gross manifest state. Yeah, then you have the cosmic manifestation. So that's the plan, and then he has Brahma work with the plan. While he's lying in a mystic slumber. One sense, doing nothing except empowering Brahma to do his thing, and then Brahma empowers others to do their thing, and They empower others to do their thing. But where's that power coming from? So the whole of the Vedic, all this description is to help us understand the all-powerful supreme cause of all causes. Therefore, we should surrender unto him. When you study carefully the verses of Brahma Samhita, that's what's going on. The verse after verse after verse, it's describing some fantastic display of creation or a demigod or devi. And she does or he does these following things and they derive their power to do so from the Supreme. Therefore, I worship the Supreme. Govindam Adi Purusham Tamaham Vajami. Now, with the matter of creation, that's what this chapter is detailing. Okay. Any questions or comments? There's a lot more discussion when we talk about the process of devotional service or how to overcome our shortcomings and struggles and stuff. So we'll have kirtan. You have something? Yeah.
So how is it? We talk about we are dependent, we are also same time, we are independent. It may be a same problem one I had in the afternoon.
Okay.
How do we every time keep remembering that we are dependent, we are not independent?
Well, there's many ways to answer that. Just try to sit down and chant the holy name and fix your mind on the holy name. And then declare to yourself or to others, I'm independent. If you're independent, then just by desiring to fix your mind upon Krishna in the form of his holy name, it would happen. But it's not happening. Mind is not obeying. It's all over the place. There's something outside of us that's preventing. There's another power. That's one. If we strive, saying the same thing another way, if we strive for purity, we'll find out where our impurity is. Very quickly. Another, it's a nice Prabhupada's way of answering this question one time. Actually, he spoke this way once in Los Angeles and once in New York. So I know the New York version, but I heard it later on. He said the same thing in Los Angeles. To think of ourselves as very tiny and dependent. Think of Krishna in the spiritual world. In the whole vastness of the spiritual sky, there's unlimited Vaikuntha planets, an unlimited vastness of spiritual Paravyom or Brahma Jyoti. In one part of that spiritual sky, there's a spiritual planet called Goloka that's shaped like a lotus. And in that spiritual planet, Krishna and Radha are enjoying transcendental pastimes with all of their associates. And in one part of that vast spiritual sky, little corner, there's a cloud. And that cloud is called the Mahatattva. It's the sum total of the material ingredients. within that Mahatattva, a portion of a plenary portion of Krishna expands as Mahavishnu, who then expands unlimited numbers of universes. And then he expands with each of those universes as Garbhadakshai Vishnu, who then generates Lord Brahma from his lotus navel. And then Lord Brahma, out of the unlimited numbers of universes, and this is one of the smallest of the unlimited universes, where Brahma has just four heads instead of hundreds and tens of thousands of heads. This Brahma creates so many planets within this universe. And in this one little universe that has so many planets, one of those planets is planet Earth. And in planet Earth, there are seven continents and many oceans. And one of those continents is North America. In North America, there's many countries, many, many states. And there's one of those states is Virginia. In the state of Virginia, there's a place called wherever we are. In a place called wherever we are, there's so many streets and lanes and avenues and so many residences on those streets and lanes and avenues. And we're in one of those residences. Even this one residence is very complicated. And there's one apartment and we're sitting inside this one little apartment inside this complex of apartments. And you want to know how to think of yourself as very small and very dependent and insignificant. Think of the big picture of things. It's very easy to see how we're very, very insignificant. And factually dependent. Factually dependent. We can't lift our hand. We can't walk across the floor. If the power is taken away from us, we're dependent at every moment. Factually, we're dependent at every moment. And the best way to realize that dependence is to enter into the mood of dependence, and then you really feel the empowerment. It's not like off and on, but it's always on to the fullest degree. That's the best way. The being spiritually connected. Of course, that takes some cultivation and takes some purity. That's the best way. See the big picture of the things and just be realistic. Be honest with, be self-honest. We're dependent. All the time, we're making our plans, and we have no idea if they're going to happen. And that's reality. Something?
Yeah, I'm just thinking that this whole section of creation, even though, like, some groups are less complex, but in order to really is doing things that could create like a proper routine, you don't know how can I cover this, but like it seems to probably not as a place that creates that conscious codes. Is that what
that's what's intended? That's why. Why would Maharaj Parikshit, who knows that he was going to die in 7 days, and he starts asking about this topic? Why? 7 days. And it's kaput, it's over. And the answer is to help, because he's heard, his duty is to hear, chant, and remember about the personality of Godhead in a good beginning place. To hear, chant, and remember about the personality of God, it is about this created thing that's around us in all directions, the cosmic manifestation. And how wonderful is Krishna, how amazing is this arrangement that he uses to make it manifest and sustain it, and teach lessons to living entities as much as they want to receive lessons, how to come to him by using this in the proper way. That's the purpose behind hearing all of these messages. Anything else?